Germ Warfare is Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas. You know, I had an interesting incident that happened yesterday. Well, okay, so let me give you some context. During 2020, when I was making video podcasts, and uploading them to YouTube, I started interviewing guests to talk about the pseudo pandemic, you know, and obviously that didn't align with the narrative pushed by YouTube, aka Google, and so the videos started getting taken down. And as we all know, you know, the mass censorship machine was getting its engine running, and as we can see now, it's extremely well oiled. And so what I did was I moved all my videos from YouTube across to a channel called, called Odyssey, which is blockchain-based and somewhat decentralized. And I shut down my YouTube channel because I couldn't use it. It had become useless. Anyway, Odyssey is a great alternative because it's blockchain-based. However, it's a bit complicated. I won't get into the details, but Odyssey can still censor. Technically, it's only censoring what's on the front end, but nevertheless, what you see on Odyssey's website can be censored. And if you really know how to work your way around the blockchain, which I don't, you can still go and find the videos. Nevertheless, Odyssey censored one of my videos, I believe this week. They only censored it in Germany. And this is quite interesting because I was sent a screenshot from a German supporter who said, take a look here, the German government has censored or has insisted that Odyssey censor this particular video. And then you can see the message there. So he cannot watch it in Germany. And the video is, it's from, I think, 2021, when I did a podcast with a Jewish historian and filmmaker by the name of David Kohl. And in 1992, he went to Auschwitz and he made a documentary there in which he interviewed the head of archives. The documentary you can't find on YouTube, obviously, because anything that is somewhat challenging to official narratives tends to get censored or removed. But I think you can find it, ironically, on Odyssey or on BitChute or one of the other alternatives. But because he questioned the official numbers from Auschwitz, and again, it's a documentary, you can watch it and you can make up your own mind. Because he questioned some of those official numbers, the German government insisted that Odyssey censor this interview. I have subsequently uploaded the video to another platform, which isn't censored, as far as I know, anyway. But the point is this. It's understandable if people take offense to all sorts of content. I get it, right? Particularly things like the Nazi Holocaust or I don't know, the Rwandan genocide, or things that are deeply connected to us emotionally. It's understandable that people have extremely emotional responses. However, these are historical events that we're talking about. And it seems to me very dangerous to try and censor history, to try and protect people from particular historical narratives. And I can't wrap my head around why this is actually happening. What is the need to criminalize somebody who is legitimately investigating particular aspects of history? It doesn't have to be the camps in Germany. It can be, I don't know, the origin of COVID. Those videos get censored also. If you claim that viruses don't exist, for example, YouTube will take down those videos. And I'm trying to wrap my head around what is it that creates this desire in some people to be protected from perhaps facts or even non-facts. Doesn't really matter, but what is this desire to be protected from a particular aspect of our existence? Are people so afraid that their paradigm might be shifted? Is that the reason? I don't know. I guess you would need to ask those people. But one thing I think is extremely important is that when certain arguments get silenced or get censored or get suppressed, there's a red flag that should be waving, definitely, because no historical event or scientific claim should ever be protected. It should always be investigated and interrogated. And I think that there is something to be, well, what's the term I'm looking for? The Barbara Streisand effect. When you try and stop people from knowing something, it becomes even more popular. So the opposite effect happens. I'm going to ask my upcoming guest, Joe Olson, about it in a moment. And he's a fellow TNT colleague. So I'm very excited to be ending the week with him. But before I do that, let's do this.
Real talk when you need it most.
It's the topics that matter to me.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Joe Olson, how's the information war treating you?
Oh, Jeremy, it's delightful to talk to you again. I wish you would put up the interview that you did with John O'Sullivan and James Fetzer and I about 3 weeks ago, 45 minutes long, really great introduction to all four of us. And we're all four on the cutting edge of the truth movement. One phrase that I really love is education is not a bucket that you fill. It is a fire that you light. And I had my fire lit many moons ago. I was very well aware of how corrupt the political structure was, particularly in the state of Texas, from firsthand experience. And I've read thousands of history and science books, and the conflicts between the official narrative and alternative evidence is absolutely glaring. What we have is a narrative that's trying to impose groupthink and create mass psychosis, which is what they've been able to do. It's so Orwellian, new speak and new think and, you know, everything involved in it. It's just overwhelming. And you have to realize that this is the same group of people that there is virtually no difference between communism, fascism, Marxism, Nazism, progressivism, socialism, any of those isms. They are all rebranded feudalism. Because there's only two means of social order. Either you have free speech, property rights, and rule by informed consent, or you do not. And if you look at all those various little isms, there's virtually no distinction between them at all. The reason they separate fascism and Nazism to be right wing is because the Fabian socialists said if we put those over on the right, and then we keep communism and Marxism on the left, then we can steer everybody through the nice, comfortable, both progressive and socialism in the middle. And that's the way they try to frame the narrative. But everything about it is absolutely 100% false.
My opening monologue there with the censorship, I mean, do you agree with me that it's a serious red flag when authorities are trying to protect people from certain aspects of life?
Oh yeah, it's mental herding of the sheep, and that's what these quote leaders consider us to be. Now, you know, many people are new to the truth movement. I've grown up my whole entire life in the truth movement. My grandfather owned 5 acres of land down on South Padre Island, which was separated by a bay between the mainland, and there was no real bridge. There was a swinging floating bridge across the Intercoastal Canal back in the 50s, which severely limited access onto Padre Island. So there was like no development down there. They knew it was going to be an enormous real estate boom, but the people who had bought the landfall for the potential bridge weren't going to allow the state to buy their land. So it was held up in eminent domain for many, many years. And my grandfather ended up having open heart surgery. So he had to put his land up for sale. He sold it for $600,000. 6 months later, the people who bought that land sold it to the state of Texas for $1.2 million. And the people who bought that land were U.S. Senator Lloyd Doggett, U.S. Senator John Tower, Democrat and Republican, the state governor and the head of the Texas Transportation Department. So these guys just absolutely fleeced the citizens of Texas, and to reorient the causeway to land on that particular piece of property required a reverse S in the construction, over $2 million of excess construction costs back in the early 70s. So I was very well aware of that. And then I went to school at U of H and took engineering and was taught by some of the best professors in the world on the English traditional scientific method, and very much loved it, very much adhered to that particular mindset and that level of objectivity. And then during the 80s, I was doing a lot of traveling around the United States. There was an economic depression here in town. I was working with a couple of local real estate developers who I didn't know were involved in a giant real estate fraud, which we'll get to in just a second. But I also started working with some architects that were doing high-end retail in a number of spaces around the United States. So I went from Seattle to Miami and from San Diego to Boston. I worked on Tiffany, Coach Leather, Alfred Dunhill, Gucci stores. And I would meet people on the airplane and they say, oh, I hear a lot about Houston, but you know, if I was flying there, what would I do? And there's like nothing to do in Houston. Rent a car, drive to San Antonio. So in the 1989, I decided I would try to give something back to my city and help make Houston a possible tourist destination by making it a more functional city. At the time, there was a discussion about having a monorail connecting downtown with two commercial developments on the west side of town. All of these properties were owned by two very powerful real estate developers here in Houston. And so they were going to use Disney monorail technology. Well, if you go to Disneyland, you might think this is some like, you know, wizardry out of the distant future. And why can't we have this all over the country? Well, there are three Disney monorails operational in the world. One of them is at Disneyland in Anaheim. One of them is at the Seattle World Fair, built in 1962. And the other one is at Orlando. What people don't know is when you enter a Disney property, you're required to sign a non-disclosure agreement and a binding arbitration agreement. And in Orlando, when you sign that, you're in a completely controlled environment where they have total control over all of the legal aspects that happen inside the Disney properties. There have been at least 9 fatal accidents on Disney monorails, because what it is nothing but an electric bus that's sitting on top of an inline skate, and it's got outriggers underneath it to keep it from tipping over. And when they were submitted for Houston, it was discovered that they had no crash testing of those things, no flame testing, and no evacuation testing. And they were proposing this, like I said, a 14-mile monorail that was going to cost $1 billion. So I started doing some further. Yes.
No. I didn't interrupt you. I was just saying, sure.
Oh, okay. So I started doing some more investigation. Turns out that these buses on inline skates cannot operate if there's more than a 2-inch-per-hour rainfall, because they hydroplane and they become unstable. They can't operate in a wind where it's over 50 miles an hour. So to claim that this is a transportation system is ridiculous. It was going to be sitting on top of a 18-inch-wide concrete beam that it runs along, 30 feet above ground. There was no access for handicap. There was no way you could get anybody out of them. The Federal Transportation Authority had listed it as an amusement park ride, and like I said, never flame tested, never crash tested, never evacuation tested. When they submitted the same technology at the same time back in the late 80s to Honolulu told Disney, this is laughable and not worthy of consideration. Well, the head of the Houston Metro, who was an attorney, was fired by our city mayor because she had made up her mind she wanted to do this rail project. And I went to his office and I asked him, why was she trying to do this? It was a violation of the state competitive bidding law. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, one of the local contractors said, if they didn't have to bid against anybody, they could hide $200 million of excess profit in that billion-dollar rail project, and we'll all get rich on it. And I went, gee, you know, so that's exactly what's happening. And that was, you know, another giant red pill moment for me. So I had one in the early 70s with my grandfather's real estate. Then I had another one with the rail system here in Houston. And then I ended up in divorce court. And one day I was walking in divorce court. I met a Houston investigative reporter named Pete Bruton, who had written a book in 1992 and had a contract with Simon & Schuster that the book be published in September of 1992 in time to affect the election of George H.W. Bush. The name of the book was The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. It's 400 pages long with a 50-page documentary on the $600 billion savings and loan engineered crisis. And so I picked up the book. I thumbed through the back of it. I knew 50 of the projects that were involved, and I knew a dozen of the people personally that I had sat in closings with doing the surveys and access easements and crossover easements and everything required to make these various projects work. And when I was working for the developers, they introduced me to a concept that I'd never known. I realized that these projects, these condominiums that they were building, were never going to be sellable. They were real high cost per square foot, real high operating costs. Nobody would want to spend their money living in any of these buildings that they were proposing. And the guy said, yeah, I know. I said, they're all going to go bankrupt. He said, yeah, I know. He said, but we're OPM. I said, what do you mean OPM? He goes, other people's money. And I said, well, other people's money is our money. We're, you know, the FDIC is insuring the Savings and Loans Corporation. He goes, it doesn't matter. We'll just go bankrupt. Well, the biggest developer that I worked with in Houston went bankrupt for over $40 million. And I personally knew a lot of the people that he bankrupted who were legitimate business owners in Houston and lost their entire business because they weren't paid. And this guy walked away with $40 million bucks, including rumored over $1 million in gold in Swiss banks. So I'm very, and he never went to jail. So I'm very familiar with how this operated. And let's don't forget that in his first couple of months in office, Ronald Reagan was shot by John Hinckley. And John Hinckley was family friends in Midland with the Bushes. And the night that the assassination happened, Neil Bush, who's one of the Bush sons, was supposed to have dinner with some of his friends from the Hinckley family, and he called and canceled and said, maybe we shouldn't. So this is nastier than most people are allowed to know.
Joe, excuse me. Using the information that you have gained over the last, 30, 40 years, how do you navigate the fog of information war?
Well, there again, I go back to traditional science and alternate sources of history. So I reframe everything that's being projected as the directed narrative for the mass hysteria. And I go, well, what are the historical contexts of this and how correct are they? And what are the empirical science proofs for what they're claiming? And that makes it pretty easy to you know, have your magic decoder ring and not be tricked by these people and help people navigate what's actually being what's actually happening. So after I got in divorce court, I could never get out of there because, you know, they've got a clever little system where if your attorney and your wife's attorney can't bilk you out of enough money, they appoint an ad litem for your children and you get to pay $300 an hour to that attorney while two other attorneys are ripping you off constantly. It's a method of bleeding families dry. It is absolutely the most barbaric system imaginable. And I got involved with the men's rights here in Houston. We managed to get five judges removed from the court in family court and three probate judges, but the entire legal system is completely corrupt. So after that, I kind of went under the radar. I did some traveling. I went to Egypt and sailed the Nile for 3 weeks. I met the love of my life in England and went to England 6 different times and traveled all over England 2 weeks at a time. So I had like a month's vacation every year going from Dover to Bath and from Warwick to White. Absolutely a wonderful period of time and enriched me, myself very much in that portion of Western culture. And then I am a trained structural engineer. I took all of the courses required to do structural engineering, but I specialized more in subdivision development, which civil engineers do. And so I wasn't really using my structural knowledge, but when 911 happened, I said, this is absolutely insane. But as an engineer, I can't make statements based on speculation. I have to have hard proof. And so I studied it constantly for 10 years. And then in 2014, Veterans Today started running articles on the nuclear vaporization of the World Trade Center towers. And that was the only thing that made sense to me. I had my first article published in a major website at InfoWars, Hoax of the Century, in April of 2009. And in May of 2009, Alex Jones had a guy named Richard Gage on as a news press conference for a DVD release in Austin. And so I drove up to Austin. It was a 4-hour-long press conference with a 2-hour-long DVD by Architects and Engineers for 911 Truth, and then about a 45-minute presentation by Richard Gage, and then a presentation by Alex Jones, and then a question and answer with the reporters that were there. I knew it was a controlled demolition, number one. Number two, I knew it was impossible to do with conventional explosives or thermite. So in 2014, when the Veterans Today articles started coming out, I contacted Jim Fetzer, and I had been contacted by Dennis Miller, who had 400 radio stations. He was former 6-year comic on Saturday Night Live. Really brilliant guy. He interviewed me on our Slaying the Sky Dragon book. And the next day I was contacted by Coast to Coast to do an interview with them. And then Jim Fetzer said, well, let's do an interview on the nuclear vaporization of the World Trade Center buildings. So all of that happened the first week of March in 2015. Jim and I went on to do probably another dozen or two interviews on YouTube, but all of his YouTube channel material was completely removed. So we've duplicated some of that material at BitChute. I currently have 220 videos, most of them about an hour long, with James Fetzer on BitChute, where we cover mostly current events, putting them in the perspective of the things that I know about science and history, which helps correct things and put them in a perspective where people can understand them. So, like I said, I was interviewed by Coast to Coast. They invited me to be on again in 2017 and then again in 2019. And then the issue of electromagnetic interference with biological systems came up. I was interviewed twice by one of the Canadian talk show hosts who is a fill-in on Coast to Coast on weekends, Richard Seert. And he said, would you agree to do an interview on the bioelectric impacts? And I had been studying that. I had to take circuits and electricity and magnetism as 2 physics courses required for engineering. So I'm very knowledgeable in how electrical systems work, and I'm knowledgeable how they interfere with biological systems. But in order to do a 2-hour broadcast with Coast to Coast, I needed to have some more information. So I contacted several other Coast guests on this, and they said, the first thing you need to do is read a book by Robert O. Becker, who's an orthopedic surgeon, was an orthopedic surgeon at the VA hospital in Syracuse University in New York. And that brings up a very interesting topic. Do we need to take a break?
We actually do, Joe. So hold that thought. I'm going to get Jeff to take us to that break. Thanks, Jeff.
Trish Wood on TNT Radio.
Remarkable display of what one could only really characterize as, it was a bit of show trial, Shocking in the narrowness and the politicization of this event in Washington on January 6th, right? I mean, I don't think we've got to the bottom of everything that happened that day. And the American media is so in the bag on this, right? It's really, it was hard for me even to process as I was watching it. I felt like I was in the Soviet Union watching a Pravda exercise. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre. The corruption in the media now, I would say, on behalf of all of the left-leaning parties everywhere in Western governments, the media is in the tank.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A lot of people may not agree with us right now, but there may come a time when they actually have an issue that affects them, that they don't have the freedom to choose. And if we don't preserve it, we won't have it.
Get to see this for yourself.
We begin this new week with an extraordinary moment in our history. 18 days into this truck convoy, and the federal government invoked a security measure that goes beyond anything seen in this country in the last 50 years.
Banks will be told to freeze the accounts of anyone helping finance the protests. And the owners of vehicles jamming streets will be directly targeted.
Trucking for Freedom, Chapter 1, How We Got Here. Visit truckingforfreedom.com.
Mercy Ships is putting faith into action to help the forgotten poor. And our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship with volunteer medical staff and crew will double our ability to help those who need it most. Go to mercyships.org today.
Government faked a pandemic.
Government faked a test.
Government faked a cure.
Government must be held accountable.
There's nothing fake about us. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Joe, what are your views on Judy Wood's hypothesis? Where did the towers go? I interviewed her on my own podcast some time ago. Listen, I've got to be honest. She makes some very, very persuasive points.
Yes, I heard her multiple times. James Fetzer interviewed her like three or four times. She was interviewed numerous times on InfoWars. She's been interviewed on Coast to Coast AM. And I've heard all those broadcasts. When she first came out, I went to her website and I spent probably 40 hours reading everything that was available on her website and watching all those various videos. And I had a half dozen questions. And so I contacted her and I said, Judy, I would, like to have a little bit more information. She goes, well, have you bought my book? And I said, no, but if you can answer these half dozen questions, I will gladly buy a copy of your book. And she goes, well, I'm not going to answer any questions unless you buy your book. And I said, well, you're not in the process of disseminating truth. You're in the process of selling books, and I'm not in the process of supporting ideas that I have questions about. So I'm not going to buy a copy of your book. Her theory is directed energy weapons, and she's kind of meandered all across the court as far as how those energy weapons were deployed on that particular event. I agree with her calculations on the amount of mass of material that was vaporized that day, which you can't do with thermite, and I agree with her hypothesis on the amount of energy it took to make two 1,350-foot tall towers collapse in 14 seconds, exactly with the same failure mode. But the buildings were built on exactly the same blueprints. So they were twin towers because they were actual twins. The only real difference is that one of them had a broadcast antenna on the top, and that antenna had a hat structure that distributed the antenna roof load down through the top three or four floors of that north tower. But other than that, what she says that I have a real conflict with is she never located initially where the dew weapons were supposedly directed from. And then she came up with a hypothesis that they were directed over at a fort somewhere, an abandoned military fort over in Brooklyn. And if you look, pull up a map, it's like the line of sight couldn't have possibly done anything below about the 10th floor of the building. So if you're using directed energy from a couple of miles away, first of all, there's a big drop off in the amount of delivered energy based on the distance that's involved. It's somewhat reduced with lasers and with directed energy weapons from the normal equation about the cube of the square of the distance, but it would be impossible. And the amount of electrical generation that it would take to project that amount of energy was not really feasible. Now, what I did is after I was contacted by Robert David Steele to write a memo to the president, he said, we need to write a memo to the president about what really happened on 9/11. And he said, the president will not read anything more than 2 pages, and he won't look at anything that doesn't have a picture attached to it. So Robert David Steele contacted 28 authors. James Fetzer was one of them. Richard Gage was one of them. I was one of them. And I wrote my article, Twin Towers Destroyed Using Clean Nukes. And this was in August of 2018, as we were approaching another anniversary of the vaporization of those towers. And I didn't really want to get much more involved in it. I'd done, like I said, videos with Fetzer on it, and I had done sufficient research as a structural engineer to know how the buildings were built and the only method of destruction. But then in 2019, when I was invited to be on Coast to Coast again, knowing that they had had Richard Gage and Judy Woods as guests about the World Trade Center buildings, I thought, well, I'll just write another article. So I wrote one called Unequivocal 9/11 Nukes. And this was posted at Veterans Today. One of my readers contacted me and said, you need to read the Palmer report, P-O-M-M-E-R report, done by, I want to say Heinz Palmer, but it was 4 European physicists, one from France, who I've actually debated on another program, and then 3 from Germany. And it is a 5,000-word article with 50 PowerPoint slides showing the exact sequence of destruction and 3 90-minute videos, which explain all of the PowerPoint slides. When I forwarded it to the editor at Veterans Today, Gordon Duff, he said, my God, these guys have independently proven everything that we've written in 80 articles under nuclear education that are posted at Veterans Today. And I had read all 80 of those articles concurrently as they were posted. And there was a number of concepts that I wasn't familiar with, even as much study as I put into nuclear weapons and nuclear decay. There was a lot of concepts that I wasn't familiar with. So to read those 80 articles, I probably spent 2 or 3 hours a piece just vetting all the material to completely understand it myself. So this was absolutely a breakthrough. But what these guys had failed to notice was that the building itself, the very construction materials for the World Trade Center buildings, worked as a gamma ray absorber. So Judy's correct. It was a directed energy weapon. She's incorrect as the location and the method of operation. These were plasma bunker buster bombs planted on the granite bedrock underneath the building, inside the concrete, 50 elevator shafts and 3 stairway shafts that were the core of the building. And as you directed that gamma ray force up through the building components themselves absorbed those gamma rays. And then as you ate the core of the building out, you started pulling the floors down from the very center. And as the floors fell down, they collapsed the triangular section of air between the collapsed floor and the core of the building and the exterior wall, causing the what they call squib lines puffing out under the floors as each floor collapsed and pulled the outer walls down on top of themselves. I go into more detail in that in another article that I wrote called, boy, wouldn't you know, Mind Like a Steel Trap, Exposing the NIST, N-I-S-T, Jenga Game, which was also published about a month after the Palmer Report at Veterans Today. The Veterans Today article was posted as Breathtaking Solving Nuclear 9/11. And so I've had more extensive. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I want to butt in there if you don't mind, but what you're suggesting is that it was controlled demolition, but the demolition was nuclear. Is that right?
That's correct. But and there's now, ample lines of evidence for that. Go ahead.
Okay. No. But I'm trying to wrap my head around this because nuclear means radiation, not so?
Correct.
Okay, I'm quite confused. You're going to have to explain this to me.
Okay, all right. There's multiple forms of nuclear bombs. You know, everybody's familiar with the neutron bomb, where you just send out a whole bunch of neutrons and you can kill everything that's organic, but you don't destroy anything. So you set off a neutron bomb and you can kill all of your enemy and all the bacteria and all the anthrax that you spread on the battlefield. But then you can go in and reclaim a month or two later, after the nuclear radiation levels drop down, you can go in and reclaim all of their war materials and you can reclaim all of their buildings. So that's one weapon that's nuclear. Another one is EMP, where you send a high voltage electrical charge through the atmosphere. And this happened with Operation Starfish, when they blew a nuclear bomb high in the altitude. I think it was about 200 miles in altitude above Johnson Island, and they knocked out the power grid in Honolulu. So we've known about those methods, but you're probably familiar with the bomb that weighed 30,000 pounds called the mother of all bombs. It was supposed to be a bunker buster and could supposedly break up bunkers down to 1,000 feet deep. They only made two of those. They ended up dropping one because the components decomposed. They dropped it in Afghanistan towards the end of the Trump term, just to demonstrate how powerful this bomb was. But it was actually useless. It was superseded by what were called gamma ray bunker buster bombs, where you could drop a nuclear bomb and it would hit the surface of the ground with gamma rays pouring out of the face, and it would bore down 4,000 feet with real high pressure as it was vaporizing the material in front of the bomb. And if you hit any corridors or pipes or conduits that were part of an underground bunker system, you would stream that material under high pressure and heat into those different cavities. And so they had developed these as a bunker buster bomb. The World Trade Center buildings are built on granite bedrock. That granite bedrock at the time of the last ice age was 400 feet above sea level and had 1,000 feet of ice on top of it. As the ice ages ended, that glacier retreated and dropped 40 feet of glacial till on top of Manhattan Island. And so when they started doing the excavation for the Twin Towers, they got down to the granite bedrock, and there was no way to do the granite bedrock if you only had 100-foot mud and rock fill between you and the Hudson River, which was 15 feet below grade level at that point. If you started blasting, you could send shockwaves through that perimeter wall and flood the whole basement. So they built a concrete perimeter all the way around it called the bathtub, and that remained after the demolition of the towers. Now, what happened is they built five levels of underground parking, and all of them had the center core elevator shafts. And so you go in and you plant a nuclear bomb in the basement of elevator number 50, which was the only one that had a continuous elevator shaft all the way up to the top, and it happened to be in the very core of the center. And that you use the granite bedrock as a tamper and a lens to force the nuclear power up through the core of the building. Now, the concrete that lined those elevator and stairway shafts is made out of four elements. That's calcium, carbon, silicon, and iron. And steel is made out of carbon and iron, and concrete is made out of the other three elements. And together, you have 24 stable isotopes for those four elements, but in total with the radioactive elements, you have a total of 102 isotopes. And the building remained 2,500 degrees hot despite daily pouring of water on it until December of 2001. So for months, you had these decay cycle of most of these things had about a 30, 90-day half-life. You had the decay of all this radioactive cement and the radioactivity that had been projected into the granite bedrock that was underneath these buildings. And you had plumes of radioactivity that washed across Brooklyn and caused latent cancers that take about 20 years to develop. And where did we have most of our COVID deaths? Oh, yeah, it was all these people in Brooklyn that were elderly people that had lung cancers that were all caused by nuclear activity. So bottom line is the evidence trail is overwhelming, And if you don't believe it, then let's just have a national debate on it. I'd be happy to. I'm sure that Heinz Palmer would be happy to. I'm sure Gordon Duff and James Fetzer would be happy to. Let's have a national dialogue on how two 1,300-foot-tall buildings fell in 14 seconds. And surprise, surprise, exactly 12 seconds prior to each one of those collapses, there was a 2.2 Richter scale explosion that was picked up on seismic gauges. And so that's the initiation period it took for that blast to start going up through the core of the building before the top of the building started falling down, because the whole entire core of the building was eaten out. So that's how they did that one. Yes, go ahead.
Well, obviously, then I have to ask you, I can't believe I'm actually asking this, but I actually am asking this. Here we go. Were there planes? Is that a misdirection?
I think what my working hypothesis is at this point, and a lot of the truth community on 911 agree, is that those were cruise missiles that were used as a focus point for a holographic projection, because they were flying at speeds that you cannot possibly fly a passenger plane at 1,000-foot altitude. Because the high bypass turbofans bypass 90% of the air through the plane's engine. And so you have this giant turbofan that at 30,000 feet can pass an enormous amount of air through it. You can go 500 miles an hour. But if you bring that thing down to 1,000 foot, you're limited to about 250 miles an hour before you get so much air pressure in front of that 15-foot diameter turbine blade that it becomes a brake. It can't pass that much air through the blades. And so then you put so much stress on that you rip the wings off the plane. Now, if you follow the radar tracks, but there again, there's so much misinformation, it's hard to sort out what data you want to believe. And so do you believe the FAA on their tracking radar information? Do you believe that just by accident, all of our NORAD were on training missions out in Alaska and North Dakota so that they weren't available to intercept these supposedly hijacked airliners? You know, the problem is they create just exactly like they said they were going to do with the event 201 pre-planning for the pandemic, flood the zone. These people have access to all of the information and all of the, quote, authority figures, and they can put out so much information that it's very difficult for anybody to sort through the chaff and actually end up with the wheat. But I think that after me spending 10,000 hours in the last 20 years studying 911 as a very interested civil engineer that wanted to know what happened with the three largest structural failures in the history of structural engineering, that along with a large group of people that have put this information together, we have a very coherent and understandable method of operation on how this actually went down. And it was 100% a directed event that had a predicted outcome. There was a whole bunch of things that were involved in this. Building 7 had been a federal Building 7 had been a federal facility where they stored the information on the Project Hammer, $300 million worth of bonds that were issued to go in and seize the assets of the Soviet Union after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And those bonds were due on September 11th, so they needed to destroy that evidence. In addition, they had all the original evidence on the Soros oil for food in Iraq. They had the evidence on the .com and the Enron scam. So they had this enormous amount of supposed original source, not to be duplicated, criminal evidence that had been sitting there waiting to be destroyed. And that's why they destroyed one of the reasons why they destroyed Building 7. And we didn't get into Building 6. There again, I don't want to spread myself over absolutely everything. So I didn't really get focused on the Pentagon, other than there's some people who claim to be truthers on the Pentagon who I've met in person that I don't trust, and I don't trust their information. So There's people that I would direct you to as far as accurate information on what happened. The best would be Field McConnell, who was a former Marine pilot. Then he was an U.S. National Guard Air Force pilot, and he was a commercial pilot, I believe, for Northwestern Airlines for like 30 years. Extremely knowledgeable. He's the one that was first to bring on the evidence about the senior executive service and Serco. And Serco is the largest company you never heard of, which all of these are British monopoly front companies and grooming organizations where they set up their worldwide piracy. So he'd be one of the best sources on that particular event.
All right. Well, before we carry on, Joe, let's just quickly do an ad break. Thanks, Jeff.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
In a March 19 executive order, President Zelensky invoked martial law to ban 11 opposition parties. The outlawed parties consisted of the entire left-wing socialists or anti-NATO parties in Ukraine, openly fascist and pro-Nazi parties like the Azov National Corp were unaffected by the presidential decree. President Zelensky ordered an unprecedented domestic propaganda initiative to nationalize all television news broadcasting and combine all channels into a single 24-hour channel called United News to tell the truth about war. On April 12th, President Zelensky announced the arrest of his main political rival, Viktor Medvedchuk, by the SBU security services.
Are you finding it harder to do the things you used to do, like vacuuming or getting to appointments? If you need a bit of support at home, the Australian Government's My Aged Care is your starting point to access services. You'll find all the information and advice you need in the one place. To find out about other services, eligibility and costs, call 1800 200 422 or go to myagedcare.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra, spoken by Heather Christie.
Carbon monoxide is a colourless, odourless gas that can be fatal. Don't use anything indoors that burns fuel, such as gasoline-powered generators, camp stoves and lanterns, or charcoal grills. Opening doors and windows or using fans isn't enough. Have your vents and chimneys checked to make sure water heater and gas furnace exhausts aren't blocked. If you feel sick, dizzy, or weak while using a generator, get to fresh air right away. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I am chatting with TNT colleague Joe Olson, and we're just kind of riffing. It's Friday, but we spent the last half an hour so chatting about 9/11. And I must say, Joe, it is really interesting because this is one of those global events that probably has the largest amount of misinformation in at least the last 20, 30 years, right?
Yeah, and look at what the net result of this was. We ended up invading Afghanistan, killing probably a million Afghanis. We ended up invading Iraq under completely false hypothesis that there was WMDs over there and there was yellow cake and all the other phony baloney stories that they pumped out on that. Killed over a million Iraqis, littered the country with depleted uranium artillery shells and depleted uranium armor in our tanks that got knocked out. So, you know, we've destroyed the actual breadbasket and birthplace of civilization, if you want to believe that particular directed narrative. And then the Obama administration had the Operation Zero Footprint, where they funded the Muslim Brotherhood and overthrew the governments of Tunisia, Yemen, Egypt, and Libya. And then they took the Libyan weapons and used Operation Timber Sycamore, another CIA operation, to try to overthrow the government in Syria. And now we've got the Soros-directed Orange Revolution from 2014 in Ukraine, where they set about trying to destroy all of the Russian heritage people that lived on the eastern side of Ukraine and do a racial purge there. And Putin is pushing back on that. And so now we're faced with this, you know, this multiple threat level where Putin, not only with a half dozen Facebook posts in 2016 was able to steal the election from Reptillery, a scaly, cold-blooded, fork-tongued predator, from Orange Man Bad. But now Putin is able to completely dominate the whole world market by forcing us to put sanctions on him and taking the Russian oil off the market. And all of a sudden, we've got this massive amount of inflation, which is all planned. And we could get back to the origins of the slaying the Sky Dragon. I was contacted by John O'Sullivan because we've been writing articles at some similar websites for about a year. And he said, well, you know, we really ought to write a book. And I went, yeah, nobody's written the book about what's really happening in the climate. So let's do that. So in September of 2010, we started organizing our book, Slaying the Sky Dragon. The e-version of that was issued on Thanksgiving Day, 2010. And immediately one of our co-authors, applied mathematics PhD professor at University of Stockholm, was censored by their university for expressing a mathematical formula in our book that had been used as the basis for thermodynamics since 1870. And he was not allowed to teach that anymore. So that gives you an idea the level of obstruction that's going on. And so then we, in 2011, we realized that we were not going to get any traction for our book in any of the mainstream media in or any of the scientific journals, that we were being completely ignored, and that the climate was a three-sided fake debate. You have a group that's sponsored by one group of plutocrats that operate through a number of different fronts, including Heartland Institute and Heritage Society, which I've been to both of their events that were absolutely ridiculous, where they have claimed skeptics that say carbon dioxide only warms a little. And then we had the heavily funded, over $100 billion of funding for carbon endangerment findings. And like I wrote in one of my articles at Canada Free Press, if all you fund is findings for danger, danger is all you're going to find. And so that's why we end up with all these polar bears and, you know, global warming is going to force all the women in Africa to become teenage prostitutes. And, you know, every ridiculous hypothesis that they could claim carbon dioxide on was deified, so or demonized. And so John and I said, well, the only way around this is for us to start Principia Scientific, which we did in 2011. And I recommend people go to that site. I've got probably 60 articles there. But we have some of the best science, and we try to be very objective. We try to be inclusive, so we will include stuff that has some alternative viewpoints for discussion purposes. But we're very much concentrated on the traditional scientific method, and that's why we did that. And we kind of skipped over the body electric secrets. This is an article that I wrote at Principia Scientific on November 25th, 2020. This was 2 days prior to my interview with Richard Seard on Coast to Coast. And like we had mentioned, Dr. Robert O. Becker was an orthopedic surgeon. The VA provided medical services to wounded veterans, and that included veterans that were wounded after combat. And so these guys would show up at the VA hospital. They have multiple fractures, and some of their fractures would heal like, you know, normal, and some of them would like never heal. So Dr. Becker was wondering, why do we have this differentiation in the same patient with similar injuries in one area of the body and not in others? And so he also wondered about why in the evolutionary scale at the salamanders, creatures lost the ability to regenerate limbs. And so what happened is that the salamander, you can cut an eye off, you can cut a limb off, and it will completely regrow those. And a lizard can regrow a tail, but they can't regrow a whole entire limbs. And so he wondered what it was that was the mechanism for that. And so he started doing experiments, and he found out that it was direct current running through the sensory and motor nerves that operated at milliamps and millivolts that directed regeneration, and that he was capable of regenerating lost limbs in lab rats by 1965, when the federal government quit funding his research. And Joe, so there again, that's a perfect tie-in with the 5G stuff. Yes, go ahead.
But we have to cut it short because we have reached the end of the show. However, I think this is a good cliffhanger for a follow-up conversation if you are keen to come join, because there is so much to talk about.
Oh, so much. Yes. Delighted to talk with you anytime. Love your work.
It's a great pleasure to talk to you too, Joe. And you, did you say you're in Houston?
Yes. And tomorrow night, fantastic. TNT is going to have Mark Morano on. So we're going to do a two-hour discussion on climate change. Yes. So that'll be great. And like Morano had posted my articles, and I'd met him at two events. So
cool.
Yes, Joe, looking forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for chatting to me, Joe Olson. And thank you to Jeff for making everything work all the way in Australia. I'm in South Africa. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.